to Big Nerdy Questions. This is the night, folks. We've been telling you about this as a milestone for weeks and months, and it has finally come to pass. We have very special guests in Big Nerdy Headquarters. Please welcome Eric and Julia LaWall, the producers of X-Men, the animated series, one of the best cartoons and comic series ever made. Welcome to the show.
Woo! Thank you so much.
Thanks, Josh.
And tonight's Big Nerdy Question, of course, is a bit of a gambit for us. But we will be having a jubilee tonight as we look at the question that will be a beast for all of us. Who is the most powerful X-Men in the animated series?
Most powerful mutant.
And most powerful mutant, correct. Not necessarily X-Men, it could be mutant.
Ah. Oh, mutant, oh, that stands it.
And I want to introduce, you know him, you love him, and on a Marvel episode, we couldn't do it without him. Welcome back, Matt.
I will say, use my little introduction time here, these two people are partially responsible for my childhood. So I'm going to try not to freak out too hard. But I make no promises.
We will do the best we can, because the sentiment is mutual, sir. So we're very happy to have you both on. But before we can go on, this is a big nerdy question. So we have a sponsor. Who is it tonight, Matt?
Well, Josh, today's episode is brought to you by Canada. Canada, come for the beautiful wilderness, stay for the Weapon X project.
Very good.
I mean, adamantium is the fifth largest export of Alberta, so I've heard.
Well, it should be, if it's not out of it.
Maybe they can put that through the pipeline. It's a little bit safer. We always do a big nerdy recommendation, and Eric and Julia, I know that you've worked on a show that didn't get as much publicity as X-Men Animated Series, and you'd like to tell us about it as tonight's big nerdy recommendation. What's the show?
And I'm going to actually back out of this one because I can't claim any credit on this except just admiration and love for the work that Eric and several other folks who worked on X-Men TAS did. A really remarkable show that came out shortly after, and we can give you a quick story on that too.
Yeah.
It is
Exosquad, which was a 52-episode continuous story, and a lot of the same people that did X-Men did Exosquad. The designer, supervising producer was Will Mineo, who was the designer, supervising producer for the first series of X-Men. He continued to help a little later on X-Men, but to the great shock of people looking back, when we did X-Men, we spent 6 months and got the first season done.
First 13.
And then there's about a 4 or 5 month wait to get all the animation back and get the shows produced. And we were all let go. They didn't think there was going to be a second season. Because there never had been, really. So in the interim, as soon as we were done with the first season of X-Men, a friend of ours named Jeff Siegel at Universal called us over and said, "We got this cool show, Exosquad, and we want you guys to develop it and do it. So we did Mark Edens and Michael Edens, who did half the writing for X-Men TAS, and I developed and did the first 13 on Exosquad while we were waiting for X-Men to get back going and to see if they get picked up or not. And once X-Men was picked up, I had to leave to go back to X-Men. I wanted to. And so Mark and Michael took over for the last 39 episodes and ran that show. So the three of us together were very much in X-Men and at the same time very much doing Exosquad. The sad thing was Universal, who produced it, didn't understand kids' programming, didn't have a clue. And so when they decided to call up the TV network, say, "Hey, we've got a cool show here. Where can we put it?" Everything was booked, and it was played at 3 or 4 in the morning. It was popular among Stone College students. But not among the focused audience. The toys sold great. The show, in retrospect, we thought we did as good a job and that it was as sharp a show and as adult a show as X-Men was. But nobody saw it. If you can find it.
Let us recommend Exosquad.
Exosquad is the official Big Nerdy recommendation with Eric and Julia's seal of approval.
There you go.
Professor X's seal of approval, perhaps.
I hope so.
Since he is the most esteemed character, we might say. So, before we get into the big nerdy question of the day, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the show, just some general questions. And I first think, you know, 20 years, a little bit over later, how does it feel to have created something that is still in the cultural zeitgeist, and not just comics, but a lot of people in the millennial generation think of your cartoon as the first thing they think of with Saturday morning cartoons and with animation in general?
That's tremendously gratifying to hear that. Not the irony, but as you might suspect, when it was happening, it was controlled chaos, and there was little to no expectation of success for a lot of reasons. In that Fox Kids Network, Fox didn't exist until 2 or 3 years prior to that time, and for you younger people, it's easy to forget that once upon a time you had three major networks, you might have two syndicated networks, and you might have a UHF channel. That was it. Cable was a fairly recent development at that time in terms of national saturation, and Fox Network was a brand new network, and there hadn't been a new network successfully launched since the dawn of
TV. Yeah, for 50 years there were three networks, and that was it. And if you wanted a show, a serious show produced, you had to sell it to one of those three networks. And Fox came along, and they were scrappy and took chances and pushed the envelope a little. We never would have been able to make X-Men for one of the other three networks. Their censors just would have been so heavy-handed and so unimaginable. But Fox took chances because of Margaret Lesh and because they were a startup. They were a scrappy startup.
That's an important name. The person who was president of Fox Kids, which was a division of the Fox Network, is a woman named Margaret Lesh, and she loved the X-Men and had been trying herself to get it made as an animated series for a number of years when she was working directly with Marvel. Then when she became hit and no one was willing to...
Yeah, none of the networks wouldn't put it on. They just said, nah, no way.
What was that about?
Yeah, they said, you know, it's a bunch of, you know, nerdy guys in their basement. You know, a million people read the comic. We need 3 or 4 million people to watch the show. No, they're not going to tune in. And so she constantly got turned down. And when she was finally in charge of a network, she said, screw this, I'm going to put it on. And she made it happen. But to answer, go back to answer your question, it's incredibly humbling.
We apologize.
Apologize about the phones, guys.
It's okay. Yeah. I'm sure it's an important call.
It's gone. So,
we're trying to get it gone. You keep talking.
Yeah. So anyway, the idea that, because we and our friends, we're all about the same age. We're all nearing retirement. We've worked on 30 or 40 projects over the years here, and pretty much we try our best always. And just sometimes everybody comes together and they're all thinking the same way, and the stars are in alignment or something, some magical, mystical thing happens, and it goes right. And that was X-Men, and it's really humbling to be part of it, because we all know there's always something to go wrong with a project, and most projects fail, and even the ones that play well or maybe partly popular, it just, you know, it wasn't quite what you'd hoped it would be, and this was exactly what everybody wanted. Mm-hmm. And that's just such a rarity. I think all the people that came together, it was the right time in their careers. They wouldn't let it be ruined. They wouldn't let it be changed. They wouldn't let it be watered down. There's always pressures from various people on a project because there's millions of dollars involved to change it, because everybody thinks they've got an idea to make the show better, or they get worried about stuff. Oh, this isn't funny enough, or it isn't young enough, or whatever. And so you get pressure to turn it into something you maybe don't want to do, but you figure, well, they're colleagues, or they're paying for it, or whatever. Everybody in this show just decided to put their foots down and say, no, this is the way we need to do it. And the people, thank goodness the people listened, and it worked out for us.
Yeah, I was going to follow up with that, with, you know, how you wanted to do it. One of the things that amazes me going back and watching it as an adult is how you are able to address adult themes, quote unquote, while still making it a children's show. And it shows a maturity that most programs from that time period don't come anywhere close to. The only other show I can think of that's sort of a parallel is the Batman animated series from a few years later. But can you talk a little bit about how you were able to balance that? Because it's so integral to the show, I think, and to its lasting power.
And also, you mentioned Batman the animated series. That was also on Fox Kids. That just is again, one more example of the sort of visionary approach Margaret Lesh took to programming that network. It went from non-existent to within 4 years being the dominant number one children's network in the country.
Of course, it went from zero to number one under X-Men. So everybody else did fine too, but we'll take credit for that. But yeah, to answer the question, it was this weird situation where I think all of us understood, all of us had worked in animation for at least 5 to 10 years, and so we knew what it was that young viewers needed, like the spectacle and the energy and the excitement and the colors and all the stuff that kids turn into watch animation for that we did when we were very young. So we all understood, and the executive above us, Sidney Eyewater, who was the hands-on executive for X-Men, Batman, Tick, Spider-Man, like Beetlejuice, 8 or 9 of the best, of our favorite shows over the years, he was the one giving the creative notes. He understood. He was like a serious 9-year-old boy.
Yes.
He was serious about books and literature and storytelling, but he also understood you needed to blow stuff up and have supervillains attacking before every commercial. He got all of the stuff that young people needed and that television needed, but he also got the stuff that we writers who wanted to do something sophisticated and older wanted to put in the stories. And so he encouraged it. He'd push it. You know, religion? Sure, do it. If we had a different executive, it would have just been Super Friends. And not to dump on somebody's favorite childhood show.
Of course not.
But there's a bland simpleness to a lot of the heroic shows that because we looked them over. I mean, we'd seen them when we were younger. I'd loved Johnny Quest when I was 9. But we looked at them and I said, they're not really trying for ambitious stories. We've got nothing to lose. We want to tell the most ambitious stories we can because this is our outlet. And it just happens to be kids' shows.
Now, one other thing with what X-Men, when it came out in 1992, there was, 25, 30 years of comic book history at that point in the series. It had been around for a number of years, but it itself had evolved. You know, when it was in the beginning, it was teenagers kind of coming to terms with who they were and fighting within them, fighting other magical, extraterrestrial kind of creatures. By the time it came to 92, there was enough material to sort of look back and go, you know what, the most interesting in a Rod Serling Twilight Zone kind of way to tell really strong adult stories was mutant versus human. And X-Men supported that. That was part of the X-Men history at that stage. And that allowed a very tangible examination of prejudice and how people rise above or sink below.
Yeah, there were serious stuff in the books starting when they were rebooted. I'm sure you obsessive nerds know that. X-Men started out in the 60s with Stan and Jack, and it kind of hit a dead end. It really wasn't a very successful book. They were, again, teenagers in blue suits, wisecracking and fighting a kind of villain of the week. And it wasn't a very sophisticated book. There's great memories. People have great memories of it because they grew up with it or because they love how beautifully Jack Kirby draws. But believe me, looking back and trying to look for story content, 95% of what we found was 1975 onward, was where we found the compelling character dilemmas and we'd try to pick bits and pieces of the characters and come up with our fresh shown stories, but we wanted to make sure that we were absolutely honored what had come before and didn't change it. We'd run everything by Marvel and said, would Storm ever do this? Would Wolverine ever do this? And so we wanted to be true to the characters and true to the history, but we wanted to push it as far as we could.
That's very interesting to hear. And I've seen on your website you've talked a little bit about your working relationship with Stan Lee in the production of the first season, and I'm sure our listeners would like to hear a little bit about working with the maestro himself.
And before Eric jumps in on this one, just the sort of to lay some groundwork on this, back in 1992, and it's not easy to remember back then, but Marvel was not doing real well financially.
They were about to go bankrupt.
They were, and did, I believe, ultimately
go
bankrupt.
Yeah.
This was sort of a kind of emergency flare in the disguise, can we get this show to work? Can we make something work?
Yeah, okay. And it was an interesting situation with Stan, and with whom I have an excellent relationship. I worked on 3 or 4 other things with him afterwards. When he set up Stanley website, I did some development work for him on that. It's been a fascinating thing, meeting somebody that is the most giant name in the history of what you're working in.
Yep.
And he's indefatigable. He still probably has more energy than we do at 93 or 94 or however old he is.
He goes to way more cons than we do.
Yeah. But at the time, to give you the history, in 92, when Marvel and Fox and the various people that we were working for, our bosses, hired us on, they said, okay, here's Stan, and he's he's this major force in it. He came up with the original idea and the original books, and I think wrote the first 19. He'll do some advising on this. And then Marvel pulled this aside and said, you know, Stan really hasn't been involved in the books since the early 70s, so for about 20 years. And you know, his name's been there, but he hasn't really been creatively involved. And to be honest, they kind of warned us, his tastes, he does not care for the current books at all. He just thinks they're very wrong and very too adult and very too intense. And we were warned that, well, Stan may have a very different tonal idea about what the show should be than the rest of us did. But you know, obviously we're going to be working with him, and Margaret Lesh and he were very close. So Stan was very much was involved in the first season. What he did was, we had developed it. We basically come up with all the stories, come up with most of the scripts, and then Stan started getting involved once there were storyboards. And I think, and he said it was because he wasn't really comfortable giving notes on scripts because he didn't really get them. But he got the visual. You know, a script might be 40 pages of words, but if he saw a storyboard with 750 panels, it was like reviewing a comic book, and he's more comfortable giving notes at that point. Well, what happened was he did end up having a very different, younger, gentler idea about where the series should go. And what happened was it kind of came, you know, push came to shove, and we ended up kind of shaking hands in the middle, because the rest, you know, Will Mineo and I and Larry Houston, who was the head producer-director, and the people at Fox and the people at Marvel, all had this certain 90s kind of vision. And the way I would describe it was like, okay, we were doing grunge rock and Stan was thinking Pat Boone. It wasn't that Pat Boone doesn't write good music. It's just there was a culture difference. I mean, he was 35 years older than we were. And there was just a difference of opinion about where the show should go. So that was, to be honest, it was a challenge to try to honor and accommodate Stan while at the same time knowing that just about everybody else involved in the show wanted a different show. And I, of course, being the story editor or the show writer, I was in the middle, getting everybody's notes and saying, no, it's got to go this way. No, it's got to go that way. And so that was on everything I've done since with Stan, we've been on the same page and it's been very happy. But that was very much of a challenge to find a way. But the person that did, Will Mineo, had known Stan since Will was 20. Will's in his, I think, 65 now. So he's known Stan for 45 years now. And he was an intense Marvel fan, knew everything about Marvel, knew everything about Stan. And so when the two visions collided, he became the broker. he would say, okay, I'll take Stan's notes on the storyboard, you know, 90 notes or something. I'll present them to Eric. Eric will say, okay, well, here's some we can't do. Here's some we can do similarly. Here's some I'd be happy to do. And I'll bring it back. I'll explain to Stan, in Stan's language, because Will knew him so well, why it is we needed something that was more modern that he was considering. And so after one or two of those, Stan kind of got on board and everybody was happy again. But there was about a month that the show suddenly just kind of stopped. And we had creative discussions week in and week out to find a balance that would make us happy and make Stan happy.
It reminds me, I recently watched a documentary about the production of the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation. And it reminds me of the different visions between Gene Roddenberry and Michael Piller, Rick Berman, and the people working on that show. It seems like there's a lot of parallels there. Nobody's wrong. It's just a different vision of what the beloved property needs to, where it needs to go.
Exactly.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I honestly think, and you know, this is from a fan's perspective and clearly not being an industry professional, But I've always felt that the end result with that compromise winds up working out for the best for the fans, at least, because, you know, X-Men the Animated Series alongside Batman and Spider-Man, those were the three main shows that I grew up on, and those got me into comic books, and comic books got me into reading.
I'd like to speak to what you just said. I don't mean to interrupt here, but when we think of X-Men, the animated series, or Batman, or Spider-Man, we all the comic book show that was based on comic books. But I'd be very curious to find out for whom was X-Men, the animated series, the gateway into comic books.
And into books, just like what Matt was saying.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of fans of the comic books out there, but I truly believe each of the series brought a larger audience through television to the comic books themselves. And like you said, then on to reading.
I was part of that audience.
There you go.
It did a great thing. And much like the comics, I think your show in a revolutionary way was serialized, you know, which I find fascinating. And, you know, people, a lot of nerds will say, well, we have to give credit to Battlestar Galactica or Babylon 5 or Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I say give it to you guys for being a serialized, you know, fictional, you know, sci-fi fantasy kind of show, because you've had serialized soap operas like Dallas and Dynasty, but this is a different kind of serialization. It was unprecedented. It was a great creative decision.
In the first season, because that could have been the only season. There were no guarantees when you guys were called into the room at Fox to sit down and try and come up with this. That was a decision you guys made at the very beginning, that if these are our 13 episodes, let's tell the best stories we can.
And it was really Will Mineo. I mean, I was absolutely on board with that decision, but it was really Will Mineo, the designer, supervising producer, who pushed that, because he was such a comics lover and he'd been frustrated. He'd been in the business longer than I had. He'd been probably in the animation business 15 years. And he was frustrated that they never got comic books right. And he was frustrated that he said, look, the best books, stories run for books and books and books and books, and they really build. And he said, if we want to get the comic book audience, we want to make this, you know, issue 13, issue 14, issue 15, make them want to see the next one so that we have this connected. And Margaret, I mean, it's a very risky thing. And it costs by doing that, you can't show shows out of order. If you've got individual shows, you can show one. If one comes back and it doesn't look right, you can put it on the shelf and you can play another one that came back fine and spent 2 months fixing it. What happened was, the reason X-Men premiered in January rather than September when it was planned was we had some initial teething, some initial production problems. And since they were in order, Margaret Lesh took the multi-hundred-thousand-dollar hit of saying, okay, we're going to play repeats of an old show this fall. And we're not going to start X-Men proper till January because we need to have six or seven of them ready in order so that we can play them in order. Unfortunately, what that did, even though X-Men became a number one hit for them, that so freaked out the people that put the money up that they said, you can't do that in the second season. You know, they can't. So we cheated. And what we did is we had a two-parter, and then we had the little tiny thing with Xavier and Magneto in Savage Land for 9 episodes, kind of connecting these individual stories that you could kind of show out of order, and then had the story resolve on the last two-parter. So the second 13 episodes, the first two and the last two were kind of connected, and the 9 in between really weren't, but we finagled a way to make have the audience believe that they were connected. And after that, it was pretty much they wouldn't let us even do that. So we said, well, can we do 4 and 5-parters like the Phoenix Saga? And so that was a way we kept on stretching them out. We wanted to connect things. We wanted longer stories. But the business people just kept on saying, look, no other show's allowed to do this. Why should we let you do this? This costs us money. Just make individual episodes. There was a tension there the whole time.
Yeah, but it's a great decision. I wish you could have done more, but I think you did a great job. And the Dark Phoenix Saga, fantastic. I mean, revolutionary. So two quick questions, and then, Matt, I'll let you ask a few before we get into our discussion. Number one, one of our regular panelists, Ed, wanted me to ask you what your opinion is of the X-Men cinematic universe and their interpretation of the characters.
Well, and like I was saying, that the TV series was the gateway for many people into the comic books, even though it was basically as a way of introducing folks to the comic books. My big soapbox these days is that you've got the multi-billion dollar franchise with the movies, and you have a 30-40 year history in the comic books. But I swear, X-Men TAS is the bridge. If it weren't for X-Men TAS, I truly don't believe that X-Men the movie franchise would have even happened, but B would have had the success it's had.
It would. So just the reaction to it, just a little background. Margaret Leish, the same person that got X-Men on the air, once X-Men was the one hit for them, she was the one that went to the other people at Fox Movies and said, you got to do movies.
Yeah.
And even then, after the TV show was making all this money, said, well, gee, I don't know. It's probably not a market for that. You know, Superman was okay in 78. So Hollywood just didn't get it. And finally, she talked someone into making the movies. And what we have from absolutely multiple sources verified is that when Bryan Singer and his writers, because there was 4 or 5 of them, and we read some of the scripts along the way, when Bryan Singer and his writers got together to make the movies.
The very first one.
They did not read the books. They just watched our show. That's why the team is so much our team rather than a dozen other possible mixtures of X-Men from the various comic book series. And then in terms of how we think they've worked it out, pluses and minuses, we think there's we love Hugh Jackman. You know, there's been some stuff they've done. We think they got the Xavier Magneto relationship wonderfully, and that was a big thing to us. Again, that's something Stan's not fond of, having a hero and a villain be such close friends. But that was a big thing to me in telling the story. So they got that right. I don't think they've used Storm very well. I don't know. You know, we like the way we used Rogue better, but I mean, I kind of like their young Rogue. I love that actress. So it's kind of hit and miss. They've done stuff that has just thrilled us. And then they've done stuff that, has been disappointing. So it's a mixture. It's like a B reaction. They could have done terribly. They could have ruined it, and they didn't. They found. We think they found an awful lot of the same kind of good stories in it that we did. And we think they respected the characters. But there were things. Our kids went. Who would always go to us to the movies, and they do things like. Was the Juggernaut being Australian and not being Xavier's brother, and just all sorts of craziness to where they'd almost, my son Carter's across the room, he'd say, no, it was wrong, it was wrong.
Yeah.
And he'd stand up. I think they would throw they be careful about some things and then absolutely careless about other things. And we had worked so hard to respect the books that we're always disappointed when they don't bother to respect the books in the TV show. And that, those are the disappointments. The money and the spectacle, you know, they're doing fine.
Little tidbit here. When they were first casting voice talent for X-Men TAS back in 92, everything happened in 92 very fast.
Yeah, very, very fast.
Voice talent out of Canada and coming up with what kind of voice, what kind of actor could you tell someone, we want this kind of sound. And for Professor X, it was like looking for a Patrick Stewart type. And that was... And then to see Patrick Stewart years later,
that was
like,
cool.
Oh my God, that was, and with Beast, looking for a Kelsey Grammer type.
Well, I actually said a young Willem F. Buckley.
Oh, there you go.
This shows how old.
Wow.
And then to see Kelsey Grammer.
I wonder if Beast would read the Weekly Standard, the National Review.
I don't think his politics are quite that way. By the way,
he could read it, though.
Go Wolfpack. I've got my closest friend from high school teaches at NC State.
Ah, yes. Thank you. I have a master's in public history from State, so I did want to ask one other quick question as a writer, because I've written a few short stories, nothing like yours, but I always, when I'm writing a story, attach to a character as the favorite one to write dialogue for. Who was your favorite character, if you had one, to write dialogue for, or to write scenes for?
I'll give you mine, and then I'll let Eric handle the backstory on this as to how it came to be. Back when you guys sat down in the room, Fox, and I got to be a writer on the series. I was not part of the big development team, but I was a fly on the wall for most of the conversations. It was the folks we all know and love now as the team weren't necessarily, you know, the first batch that was picked in the conference room. They came to be the people that we know and love. They came to be the big film franchise. But the one that spoke to me so beautifully and eloquently was Beast. Beast was not supposed to be... I don't even think he wasn't even supposed to
be part of the main team. It was just, we all enjoyed writing him so much that we forced him to become a part of the main team. You see all sorts of development memos from the beginning, and he's never mentioned. He's just, well, he might show up in an episode or two. And that's why we put him in jail the first episode, because we thought, well, we're not going to see him for 6 or 7 episodes, so why not? And we got to enjoy writing for him so much that we shoved him into the main team, and by the time the first season was over, he was part of the core.
And if you go back through, a lot of fun Easter eggs. Larry Houston and Will Mineo did a phenomenal job, specifically Larry Houston, of planting little bits throughout the episodes. But if you go in and see Beast's library, as people with books full of shelves full of books, they are all specific books that would have been appropriate for Beast to have read or be reading at that time. Animal Farm or You Can't Go Home Again. These kind of little salutes that if you know what you're looking for, it's like, yeah, okay, great, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I will say, as a growing up, you know, as a very nerdy guy, but also I wasn't super popular for various reasons. I really latched on to Beast as a character that's like, I want to be comfortable in my own skin. He's a nerd, but he embraces who he is. You know, he's probably the most comfortable of all the mutants, good or bad, even though he's got blue fur. Yeah. But he's still genteel and smart and nice. And I really, Beast, if I had a role model in the show, Beast is it. He really spoke to me when I was growing up. So thank you for writing through him.
Yeah. Oh, just Matt, just so you know, everybody, all the writers out of, you know, 20 people that wrote for the show, everybody's knee-jerk, you know, first thing, I want to write for Wolverine because he's so damn colorful.
Yeah.
And he just jumps off the page and he gets to be rebellious and nasty. And I say I felt bad for Cyclops because he had to be such a straight arrow all the time. But I also, my favorite, I mean, Beast was incredibly fun, but the one I think I took the most pride in writing for was Professor Xavier, because he was, maybe it's because I was in charge of a bunch of writers, he was the one that was responsible. He was the dad. And we just had a couple of children. He was the dad that had to make sense of it all and had to tell all these warring people, I mean, in his family, guys, you got to get along and fix this because there's a greater good here. And so getting inside his head was probably the most satisfying of the writing for me.
Wow.
And he ended up being, I think, a larger part of the show than anybody anticipated.
That's true.
Because most of the people involved are marketing people or money people or, you know, and they say, oh, who's the old man in the wheelchair?
Right.
So he's not hot, hip, relatable, marketable. You know, I'm sure his toys didn't leap off the shelves. But for us writing it, if you didn't have him at the center, the second season, we specifically thought, what's going to happen to the X-Men if he's gone for 9 episodes? How are they going to cope? Because he's so important. And that, you know, he continued to be for us.
Thank you. Matt, would you like to ask a question or two before we get into the – I know we're only going to have about 20 minutes, but do you have any questions that you're burning on?
Well, I think it's more of a commentary than a question because this is me we're talking about.
Of course.
And I do have a habit of monologuing, so I'll try to be brief. But I think one of the things that was so important about – X-Men TAS, just for my generation, because I'm from that border where Gen X meets the millennials, where it's kind of blurred and they don't really fit into either generation. And I think for our little group, X-Men TAS was extremely important because, yes, it was a show for children, but it still told these mature adult stories in a way that respected the intellect of the audience. And, you know, I was 9, 10, 11 years old watching this show, and I was completely engaged by the story, and I realized large portions of it were episodic because that's the way these things go. But to me, as a young audience member, you know, starting watching the show while I was in middle school, to me, there was an overarching story, and that was the coming of age of Jubilee.
Yeah.
And I always felt, to me, I always felt like she was the main character for really the whole time, and she and her coming of age was being set in the backdrop of the X-Men and the chaos of, you know, all the discrimination between mutants and humans.
Yeah.
Good. I think that's fair, yes.
Absolutely. And you get a sense of that. I mean, we wrote the pilot specifically. We thought, well, we need to have somebody that the audience can identify with to come in, because it's hard to imagine now, but as Margaret Lesh said, 85-90% of the people thinking about tuning into the show won't know what the heck a mutant is or why the X-Men are the X-Men. So we wanted to have someone from the outside, fresh, just as unknowing as the audience, to come in and learn what it meant to be a mutant along with the audience. And so that was very, very much on purpose, that we started the series through her eyes and felt it through her. And I'm sure we moved her to the back sometimes because, you know, she's a teenager, and if there was a tough situation, a lot of times we'd give the biggest responsibility to the adults. But she did grow, and she did become, you know, a worthy part of the team, and she proved herself. And that was a big – everybody else had always been there in our timeline. So they were already there. They were already family. They already had proved themselves. And she had to. And so that, you're right, that was a major for her.
The frequency of, no, Jubilee, you have to stay behind and watch the mansion be drastically dropped from season to season. You can actually see her becoming more accepted as time goes by and being left behind less frequently and really becoming more part of the team as she's coming into herself and growing to accept her powers and honestly becoming much more powerful as well.
Yeah. And smarter and just more experienced. And that's great. We were looking back, we're surprised the number of people we've talked to have said, Jubilee was my way into the X-Men. was my favorite character. And mm-hmm. perhaps it's because of their age at the time, but maybe it's just that her situation was different from all the others and special.
Yeah. And relatable.
Yeah, I can say that was the case for both myself and my brother.
So, it's probably a good segue since we're talking about the team. We have a little bit of time, and I want to talk about our official big nerdy question of the week. And our big nerdy question came to us from Mandy, who is the head of the podcast Little Geek Lost out of Canada. Unfortunately, she's under the weather tonight, but she posed the question originally on Twitter of which mutant was the most powerful X-Men in the animated series. And I chimed in, and then you guys chimed in as well, and the rest is history from a few months ago. So now we're here together. But I figure since she's not here, I'll be her voice first. She told me she wanted me to pose as the first option for our pick, Jean Grey. And she felt that Jean Grey was the most powerful, not necessarily because of the Phoenix, because as Matt pointed out to me earlier, the Phoenix is not a mutant per se. It's a different sort of animal.
Right, the Phoenix Grey, is a celestial force.
Exactly. But Jean Grey on her own, because of her abilities with her mind and also all the other things she can do with it, is a powerful mutant in and of herself. So what do you, Eric and Julia, think about Jean Grey's abilities, and how do you conceive them?
Well, let me ask a question to the question. we're hearing from our son across the room, Proteus.
Because Proteus made Wolverine cry. cry out of fear.
Yes, but in terms of when we say powerful, what are we talking about? A team member in terms of taking on another team, another bad guy, or I think if she goes Phoenix on you, she will destroy you, but she will destroy everything around her
everything
as well.
Everything around her, yeah. When, I think she initially conceived the question as powerful in just the most typical sense of in a fight, but. On Big Nerdy Questions, we like to take powerful and different, and we like to take words in interesting interpretations. So, however you want to interpret power, I'm going to interpret power in a little bit different sense in a minute. So, however you want to interpret it. But I guess from the creative point of view, when you were writing for Jean Grey, what did you think of when she was using her abilities and her role in the team?
Yeah, I actually... I didn't like to think of anybody as being more important to the team than anybody else. And in that way, we tried to feature everybody constantly. There are certain people out there in Hollywood say, oh, no, you need it to be Wolverine in the X-Men, or just, have a lead character and a supporting cast. And I always fought against that. And I said, how can we highlight the strengths of everybody eventually over different stories? And so my weaselly, cowardly answer would be most of them would be the most powerful X-Men for a specific situation. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to, Beast is wonderful and he's brilliant and he's strong, but Rogue can throw a bus at you and Storm can destroy your city, your village with a hurricane, and et cetera, et cetera. And Xavier can reach out his mind 1,000 miles and do it. So there are all these powers that people have. And my hope in writing it was that depending on the story, the audience would think, oh, this needs to be Storm or this needs to be Xavier to handle this problem, because they would be the strongest one among the team to handle it. The way I see Jean Grey as strongest isn't necessarily her, her mental powers. It was her personality, because we were throwing all these people together that were knocking heads and disagreeing. And I saw it, Jean Grey as kind of the indispensable person, that the glue that held the team together, because she could talk to Xavier in a way that nobody else could. She could talk to Wolverine in a way nobody else. Obviously, she could talk to Scott the way nobody else could. I think, I don't know about Jubilee and Storm and Gambit, a bit, but I think Gambit, but it was like she was the one that would always have an answer and would be able to get everybody on the same team. Whereas Xavier might be a little out of touch, Wolverine too mad, Scott too self-righteous, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Jean was this kind of center, this moral center of the team. And that way, I thought she was the most powerful at that.
Yeah. That's a great answer. Thank you. Matt, I know that you wanted to mention a mutant that wasn't necessarily a main member of the team, but that
he wasn't even a member.
No, at all. But that you think that he may have been the most powerful, maybe under the radar.
And the definition of power that I'm using here is that can have the most far-ranging effect. And for that, I'm actually picking Longshot. And for most of our listeners, they probably just collectively said, "Who the hell is Longshot?"
The guy that you flirted with.
And I actually went back over the last several weeks and I rewatched all 76 episodes available in their entirety on Hulu for our listeners who would like to and frankly should go back and watch it because it does get better with age.
Yes.
Thank you.
Longshot is a Freeman mutant in the Mojoverse. And his mutant power is he can control probability.
Right.
And he does it through controlling luck. And I've read more on Longshot, and the way it works is he takes away other people's luck to give it to himself.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's and again, I do marvel, there I be a bad punster in Josh's tradition. I do marvel at Marvel's ability over the years to create interesting characters with wide-ranging powers that don't overlap, that are distinct from each other. Like I said, we wouldn't want to make a team of the Hulk and the Thing and Colossus.
Because you two can break stuff. Okay, let's go with that.
What you want, that you want a rainbow of different distinct characters with different distinct abilities thrown together so that the stories can vary and be mysterious, so it's not just people pounding on each other.
And it's a real trick to especially you're dealing with mutants who have all different kinds of powers, to not have someone be too powerful, because then where's your story?
Yeah, you want it to. That was, I think, the hardest thing was making the Jeopardy believable and plausible and balanced, so that you understood the rules and the extent of people's powers. That frustrates me a lot in a lot of the superhero movies and some of the TV shows where they either futz with the powers or they don't make them clear, and so somebody's just destroying one person and then it comes back and they're destroying someone else and you're not quite sure what the rules are, and that to me as a viewer is frustrating. Keeping the rules really specific and keeping the odds balanced. Well, who's going to win this versus, well, hell, it's Apocalypse, he's just going to walk in and melt everybody and the show's over in 3 minutes or whatever you set up. That took a lot of juggling. And I think we did pretty well. I hope we did, because there's nothing worse than a show where, oh, we've got a wimpy villain. Of course they're going to defeat him because, you know, he's not powerful enough, or they cheated to beat him, or, you know, or somebody came up with a spare power in the last minute. You know, mm-hmm. Didn't know he could do that.
The Deus Ex Machina power. You know, yeah. I think, and we've on this show before, Matt has been vocal about that's his biggest critique of Superman, is because Superman's ability is that he can come up with any ability he needs. And it you can get him out of jail free card, essentially. And I love the fact on your show that even in situations like the Apocalypse arc, it's never impossible. So it's not a Deus Ex Machina in the end. The odds are, it's a long shot, not to use the pun. That's really what it is. But it's possible to win, and they overcome the odds, but it's not impossible. It doesn't feel like it's a cheat when he's defeated. It feels like it's a well-earned victory, and that's an important distinction, because so many times, especially today, you'll see arcs, and it's like, you set up impossible odds. Impossible odds! There's no way they could have won, and then all of a sudden, this new character has all of a sudden the ability to change time. Where did that come from? So, yeah, I agree.
I'm sorry, but I have to say it, and you got me started on this, Josh, so it's your fault. But once, and I have actually seen it, there is an issue of Superman from, I believe, the 1950s, in which, in Superman's inner monologue, he says, I am going to use my super sewing to make Lois Lane a wedding dress. Not my super speed to sew really fast. He apparently has super sewing.
You got a problem with that? I
just happen to have secret underwater basket weaving ability.
Well, how do you think he makes the suit so quickly?
There you go.
Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
Although, in his defense, for what it's worth, I think Superman is such a great, funny, grounded person who's trying to do the right thing.
Yes.
And it's a very tough sell in an hour and a half movie, and I'm not sure they've gotten it right yet.
He's always such a jerk to Jimmy Olsen.
I don't get it.
didn't he just get killed in the last one, Jimmy Olsen?
Oh, yeah.
There used to be a website that kept a tally, and the last time I checked it before they unfortunately got hacked and turned into a whole bunch of viruses, I believe the running tally was he had actually personally killed Jimmy Olsen 18 times, and he had murdered Lois Lane 14 times during their wedding.
Yikes.
I don't envy the people... A group trying to do 76 episodes of a Superman show how do you threaten him other than personally?
I mean, how does Smallville get 10 seasons? That's a feat.
I'm still trying to figure out how to get a third one.
that is a feat. But I think to credit X-Men Animated Series, there are characters that are incredibly powerful. But there's no one sense that you think, there's no way they can be beaten with Apocalypse, but there's also with Magneto, with the Sentinels. There's always a challenge, and even on our hero side, like you said, Beast is actually, if I'm going to pick a character, any one character, I'd pick Beast. But he still can be easily, it's not invincible. And I actually think Beast is the most powerful, not because of his power, his raw power, or because of his mind, but because he's the most comfortable in his skin.
Yeah.
And it lets him act to his fullest potential. And you see that time and time again, whether he's acting like Beast or like Hank McCoy, he is still the fullest Hank McCoy or the fullest Beast he can be. He's not full of the angst like some of the other characters, which I really admire.
Yeah. I think he's the wisest and the most mature, and you're right, he's the most comfortable. And that is absolutely why we came up with one of our favorite stories. We said, okay, who can we make have a personal crisis about the way they look? And, Beauty and the Beast. And that was a favorite, a close friend of Julia's ended, Stephanie Matheson ended up writing the episode. But Julia came up with the idea, and it just turned me, oh, God, that's perfect, because he has gone through so much, because he looks so strange, he can't pass, he's so mutant looking, that, and yet he has made himself accepted in the world. He's somehow gotten past all of that, has made himself accepted in the world, that he's completely at ease with the way he looks, and suddenly something makes him question that after however, 10 years of being at ease. And that was the most powerful personal crisis, one of the most in the series was, oh my God, am I acceptable to this person I've fallen for? And it just, he was great for that.
Yeah.
And you're referring to the story arc where he falls in love with his patient.
Right.
I have to say that, that's something that was memorable for me even when I was young. And going back and watching it as an adult, it's actually kind of heart-wrenching to watch it. Because and I love the massive internal conflicts that the characters have on the show, which is why, honestly, I think my favorite individual character is actually Rogue. Uh-huh. And, a decent part of that is Lenore Zann's voice acting, which I actually looked her up recently. She's actually a politician now. She's a sitting politician in New South Wales, I believe. Nova Scotia New Democratic Party. She is a member of the House of Assembly of Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
And she has since 2009.
She's the real politician that went rogue.
To the moon, Josh.
and she's very fun. She's one of the people we interviewed for the book.
Oh, she has this wonderful internal conflict who she is and whether or not she's going to accept who she is.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And that was a really important internal conflict to have, at least for me as someone at that particular age. That was something I really needed to see on the screen.
And I've always thought it's interesting, everyone on the team had their own specific issues, but if you swapped any of them out, the problems would go away. For example, if Wolverine suddenly was unable to touch somebody, he couldn't care less. He'd be happy. He'd be happy as a clam.
Get away, bub.
Poor Rogue, if she could touch someone, then suddenly that changes her entire dynamic. Everybody, if you swapped one thing with one other teammate, they wouldn't be who they were. They wouldn't have the...
Yeah, we tried to intensify that so that it became like their powers, that their personal problems became something that you'd associate with the character.
Eric, you were saying about Rogue that she was the one... that moved you forward with the cure.
Oh, the cure. Yeah, I mean, when we did the first season, we sat down and said, okay, the two guys that helped me lay out the first season and I did not know the books very well, sadly, a sad admission here. It's like you guys, we came to the books through the show.
Yeah, really fast.
And that was, it took a certain amount of nerve on our part because there are all these people that knew the books backwards and forwards that we were handing stories to. But so the first season we tried, okay, how do we best get to understand each of these lead seven or eight characters? And we said, okay, Rogue, she can't, and also we had a half dozen ideas about possible show ideas. And so we said, what if somebody had an idea for a cure? Who would be the most tempted? Leaving the X-Men is a big deal. Actually giving up your person, your mutantness is a big deal. Who would be believably tempted to do that? I don't think everybody, there would have walked away. I don't think Jubilee would necessarily have left the X-Men to get rid of her powers because they weren't a burden for her. I mean, they were a small burden, but nothing like Rogue. Okay, well, who's the big Rogue? It would be the most touching story to have her tempted to leave the X-Men and all this to just get rid of this thing that she has. And so that's why we wrote that story around her, absolutely in the service of her personal problem.
And then the films made that, I would argue, the central arc of the first three films is Rogue trying to deal with her identity and getting the cure. So they went with that direction. Matt, since you just rewatched the episodes, and Eric and Julia's son mentioned Proteus,
yes.
Matt, will you just briefly give us an outline on the man that made Logan cry?
So, Proteus is... Well, the character's been around for a while, and Proteus is a psionic-powered being. And I have to admit, I don't have a lot of background with mm-hmm. Proteus. But, yes, he did make Wolverine cry.
I mean, that's his single claim to fame.
Well, what he was is, he was Moira McTaggart's, I believe he was her son. Is that correct?
Yeah, he was. In our story, he's about 13 years old, and so he's a troubled teen, a troubled adolescent, taken to the extreme. And so what we loved about that, it was the post we did a couple days ago was we liked the distinction between a threat and a villain. He's not a villain, but for two episodes, he was this huge threat to himself, the people around him, and he was a troubled kid in mm-hmm. our story. He was blameless. So they had to solve that and deal with, there was an evil politician, dare I say it, right after the election, an evil politician, a neglectful father. There's these people that you got the sense of the story contributed to the trouble this being was having, accepting himself or dealing with himself and his emotions, because he'd start going crazy when he'd lose it a little bit, it would have impact. And so we love to always make the distinction, this may be a supreme threat to the X-Men and people they love, but he's not evil. You know, he's a troubled kid. And in that way, he was a very interesting character to me. He was, and just, I just think there was a real limit to, it wasn't an R-rated movie, there's a real limit to the violence and action we could show. It's a kid's show. And that's why I think one reason there were so many people, so much anguish, and that something like Proteus, it got inside you and drove you crazy and made you scared. And that way, we could have the characters cry out in fear as opposed to, you know, stabbing them or, you know, chopping their arm off or, you know, something in a zombie movie. We couldn't do any of the physical violence. You look back, we really had limits. So we would oftentimes find ourselves liking emotional or mental anguish as something to make for drama versus, you know, physical danger, because there's a limit to we couldn't show a Mel Gibson movie. You know,
no.
We couldn't have blood, period. I mean, we scratched somebody. Wolverine got scratched in episode 2 or 3, and that was a big deal. And we don't want to see those bandages. We don't want to see that he got scratched, that he bled. And we did that once. And then no more.
Yeah, so I want to wrap up, and I have one final thought. I think when I was truly contemplating the power of an X-Men, a particular mutant, the thought that I came to, and it may sound hokey, but it's true, the most powerful X-Men is the team of the X-Men together. You have to be, like you said, all the pieces fit together. And by the way, the characters you chose to put together in the team, fantastic. I love the dynamic and the interplay of who you chose on the roster. But you can't take away one without something falling apart, as you showed with the Savage Lands arc, as you showed when Jean Grey left and Scott quit. The strength is in their teamwork. I love the scenes when they work together, and not necessarily the action scenes, but when they're making plans together and supporting each other. Yes, they have fights. They always will. But they work as a team probably better than the Justice League and the Avengers in my opinion, it's the most seamless team in comics, the way you portrayed it. So their unity is their strength. And I know that sounds hokey, but I think that's what I've always thought.
That's very nice.
Yeah, no, that's very much that's important to us, and that was our intent all the way along. So I appreciate that you were able to get that from the other end.
Matt, do you have any final thoughts before we move on to our typical closing ceremony?
Well, I will say, and I'm sure Josh will have no objection whatsoever in life to this, but I, for one, would love to have you guys back for a later episode, perhaps in another season, to actually talk about the relationships in X-Men the Animated Series, because I love any excuse to talk about the, I feel to be all too brief, love between Wolverine and Storm.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I love that story.
Right in the feels.
I believe I got into it with one or both of you on Twitter about that a while back.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, it's the only real marriage that ever happened among the X-Men.
It's
a trivia question, because they show the close-up of their wedding rings when they have to decide, are they going to sacrifice the love?
He liked it and put a ring on it, in a way.
Yeah. How many times have you seen Wolverine with a wedding band ever? Yeah. You don't. But
you don't. No. No.
That one time with Storm.
Yeah.
Wow. And suddenly, with that story and that moment, it's like, oh my God, they make so much sense. They should have been together from the beginning anyway.
Yeah, what's
Wolverine is an inner Storm. It only makes sense to pair him with the literal Storm.
But the fact that they found each other and then the decision, the giving of that was just wrenching.
It is the animated version of City on the Edge of Forever from the original Star Trek series.
You caught us. You caught us out. Because I was 11 the day that Star Trek, the original series, premiered in September of 66. And I had never seen anything like it. And so I have the same same boy fan attachment to that that some people in their 30s now have to the X-Men. That was my eye-opener.
Mm-hmm. If I could just jump in and say, for what is so gratifying to hear from folks who were fans as you, that on our side of it, there were people took it seriously. It was a scrappy, like Eric said, kind of a grunge band put together in the garage quickly because it had to get on the air fast. Oh, and I just want a quick shout out. Eric had mentioned earlier it was supposed to premiere in September of '92, and that was with almost no prep time in the world of animation. They just had weeks instead of a year and a half. But Margaret Lesh made the genius decision when she got one episode back she could use and realized she wasn't going to have enough episodes. We'll sneak peek it on October 31st, and it became an event back in 1992. And then it was, oh gosh, we got to wait until January for the next episodes, and it played.
People remember that.
Brilliantly.
Yeah,
Halloween ever.
So the idea that everyone behind it was working so hard to make it as good as they could, and look, we can all say, yeah, it's a cartoon, but in the same way that Star Trek was a show, but my God, they can touch things inside you and stick with you forever, and
yes.
I'm a girl of things. You were a fan guy of things. Everyone on the... Oh, yeah.
It's bandied about, but you guys created a masterpiece. So, thank you. Very much for... Thank you especially for coming on Big Nerdy Questions.
It was a great privilege. And as I said, it was an awful lot of luck.
Yeah. Well, it's been our luck to have you on the show tonight. You two are unquestioned heroes of all nerds everywhere. So on behalf of all of my audience, thank you for coming on our show. We hope we can talk to you again. But we'd like you to join us for one or few more second. Well, Matt, it is Big Nerdy Questions. So at the end, we always have a ceremony and a ritual. We have to kill off Jar Jar Binks, the worst sin against nerddom in the history of America. Matt, how does Jar Jar die tonight?
Well, today we cleanse the sins of George Lucas by having Jar Jar Binks eaten by a dinosaur who then chokes to death on him once he was stranded in the Savage Lands.
So Jar Jar is a fossil, much like the idea that created him. But tonight, we thank you so much, Eric and Julia Leewald, for joining us tonight. It has been our privilege and pleasure to have you on the show. For Eric and Julia and for Matt, this is Josh saying goodnight from Big Nerdy Questions.